I will open the Joint Committee on Legislative Audits and Information Management and Technology for February 14th, 2014. Colleagues, we have quite a number of items on the agenda. It may actually take us till 5 o'clock to get through all of those items. The first item on the agenda is the adoption of committee rules. I believe you've all seen a copy of the rules. Do we have a motion? Co-chair Vega Peterson.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 14th, 2014.
Okay. Co-chair Vega Peterson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 14th, 2014. These are pretty standard rules for a committee of this type. Are there any questions? Are there any objections to the rules? Seeing no objection, motion passes. Colleagues, also, the House is in session, so the members of the House that are here are subject to the call and may have to leave. That does not mean they don't want to be here. That just means they are being called back to their chamber. Since this is a hearing and not an action, the chair will probably continue in their absence because we don't know how long they will be gone. So we will go ahead and start with the first item on the meeting, which is an informational meeting on the status report from Cover, Oregon. Is the Chief Information Officer here? Please come forward and identify yourself for the record.
And ask Amy to come with him.
Oh, and Ms. Favre, will you come with him also? Please begin at your leisure, and as you go through the report, we'll try to go a few minutes and then see if there are any questions and make sure that you can get through the report. And I believe we have about 45 minutes to get through the, yeah. Screen is, oh, there it is.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Amy Favre. I'm the Chief Communications Officer with Cover, Oregon. And I'm here today with Aaron Cargilla, our Chief Information Officer. And I was going to just kick off this update, let you know what we're going to cover today. Today we will be giving you an update on our enrollments at Cover, Oregon. Aaron will then walk you through where we are with the development of our technology, the exchange release phases, and progress that we've made in correcting functional deficiencies in our system. And then I'll close with a financial update on the status of Cover, Oregon. Next, you have change slides, please. And next slide. Thanks. Just briefly, you have before you a page that shows our enrollment numbers through Cover, Oregon. Just in summary, we have enrolled at Cover, Oregon over 102,000 Oregonians. Over 35,000 of those are enrollments in the private insurance market, and over 67,000 in the state's Medicaid system. So that's either in the Oregon Health Plan or Healthy Kids. The state of Oregon has also had a very successful effort to enroll people in the Oregon Health Plan and Healthy Kids through their Fast Track program. They've enrolled over 123,000 additional Oregonians in that program for a statewide total of over 226,000 enrollments. And just yesterday, the Department of Health and Human Services released a report that focused on enrollment in exchanges, both state-based exchanges and in the federal exchange. And Cover Oregon, Oregon ranked solidly middle of the pack in terms of enrollments, both in Medicaid and in private insurance plans. We were ranked 7th out of 15 state-based exchanges. So wanted to give you an update on that, and I'm happy to provide more information on that to you later. But for now, I will turn this over to Aaron to talk you through our technology. Oh, I'm sorry.
Senator Beyer has a question.
I'm sorry, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to think back when we the legislature enacted this, it seems like we adopted a business plan that had benchmarks of how many we wanted to have enrolled by now, and then how are we on target with that?
Those co-chairs, Senator Beyer, members of the committee. We did have, and that a business plan, which was dated January 2012, we had those initial projections. We've since revised those projections several times. And so our most recent projections, which I'm happy to send to the committee to take a look at, had a goal for us at the end of January having enrolled 20,000 people in private insurance coverage. And at the end of January, we had enrolled about 30,000 in private insurance coverage.
I guess I'm trying to reach back to the last time the legislature touched it. You know, we approved a business plan, and I was just wondering what the numbers were at that time.
Co-chairs, Senator Beyer, members of the committee, I'd be happy to send you the original business plan that has the, and highlight what those numbers are. I don't recall what they were off the top of my head. As I said, that was when we were fairly early in our work, and we have made revisions to those as our methodology has changed. But I'd be happy to send the original business plan that the legislature approved, as well as our revised projections for you to take a look at. And if you have questions, we can address them at one of our next regular updates.
Please proceed.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Cardula. I'm the Chief Information Officer for Cover Oregon. I'm here today to give you guys a clear overview about where we are with the system and where we're going with it. I want to start by talking about the phases of the system release, so which the rest of the presentation will follow, and then give you all an update on where we are with the system and what our next steps and plans are in terms of releasing the system. So as you'll see on this slide, we have split out the work into three separate phases. The first phase, which we have been solely focused on for the last several months, has been the launch of the full individual. What the full individual pertains to is the ability for somebody in the general public within Oregon to go onto the site, to compare, to shop for plans, to compare for plans, assess their eligibility in terms of a tax credit or potentially Medicaid, and then select a plan and ultimately enroll in that plan. I'll talk about the current status of that system in a second. What I will say is that we will have a final go at no-go in March. If the system is not ready by that time, we will be further assessing alternatives for how we would be bringing the functions of an exchange up within Oregon. The second phase, which we have divided our work into, is the change in circumstance, which would occur after an open enrollment period. We have begun the design of that functionality within the system. We also have additional carrier enrollment interfaces to implement. We currently have those on hold with agreement from our carriers who are using other workarounds within the system, which are basically comprised of files that we are sending to them on a regular basis so that we can update their systems with people who are enrolling through our hybrid process.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Sir, could you explain the workaround?
Co-Chair Devlin, Senator Olson, when we the term workaround refers to using some or part of some of the system or not some of the system in a way that you can still achieve the work that you need to get accomplished. So I'll give you a very specific example. So right now, in the future, we would send an automated file over to the carriers who would then load those into their system. What we currently do right now is we download information, enrollment information, out of our system. We prepare the file, and then we send it securely to them through human intervention, where they will then load it into their system. That is what I mean by workaround.
Are you saying you put it on a thumb drive and carry it over to them? Is that what you're saying?
That would not meet our security guidelines to do that.
Okay.
It is a secure transfer.
Please proceed.
The final phase that we have divided our work into is the shop portion of the exchange. As you see in the bullets below the large arrow, shop is currently estimated to be between 60 and 75% complete, but we put it on hold in preference for delivering ultimately the full individual portion of the exchange, but also in support of what is called our hybrid process, which uses many pieces of the exchange technology as well as some manual processes to achieve enrollments. So I'd like to talk a little bit about our progress on correcting deficiencies. Before I do that, I want to talk about our process that we use for correcting deficiencies. What you'll see with this slide is that we have a release process where we design and develop within the system, and then we release it and we test it. And then it gets fixed, and we test it. It gets fixed again, and we test it. And we continue that cycle until the function that we're implementing is of sufficient quality to be able to release to whichever population that would use the system. One of the things I want to emphasize is you look at the numbers that I'm going to give you on critical deficiencies within the system is we are focused solely on critical deficiencies within the system. When I give you the numbers, it does not mean that there are not other things that we will intend to address within the system, but these critical deficiencies are those things that we must address to be able to have a functional exchange, or if we can't address them, there needs to be a viable workaround, a way that we could interact with the system or potentially process something in the background that would allow us to implement that portion of the system. So that's just one of the reasons I wanted to kind of provide this process was as we're releasing up through the different portions of the exchange to ultimately the area where the users would use the exchange, the individuals would use the exchange, we're focused on those critical defects.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Sir, when you say we, are you referring to your IT team and Oracle, or is it all Oracle?
Co-Chair Devlin, Senator Olson, it is a combination between our team, my technology team working very closely with Oracle on a daily basis. We've organized around the areas of the exchange, what we call the functions of the exchange. Our people are actually, when I say our people, Cover Oregon staff are actually embedded in on-site around tables where the developers, our business analysts, and our business experts can all ensure that the development is meeting Cover Oregon needs. So when I say we, it is both Cover Oregon and Oracle.
Thank you.
Please be seated.
So there's actually two slides that provide a graphical overview of where we are in the exchange. As you can see, we have general public functionality that allows an individual or an agent to go onto coveroregon.com and submit an enrollment form, an application, where we can take that enrollment form and we can actually process it in the back end where we load it into our systems. We determine eligibility in an automated fashion. We send the outcome of that determination to the individual, who can then come back onto CoverOregon.com and select a plan, and ultimately enroll in a plan through CoverOregon.com. The areas that are still in test, we do not have areas in development in terms of the end-to-end functionality for an initial enrollment. We're in the test and fix cycle that I described earlier around the ability for an individual to go onto the exchange, choose their community partner or agent to represent them, the ability for them to go and assess their own eligibility, and also the ability for an individual to go on their own and select a plan. We are also in the test phase for all of those functions for a community partner and agent as well. So what you see and what I had described earlier is we're in the test phase. We will continue to test the system. I'm going to describe a little bit later in this update around the criteria that we would release the system under. But we are in that test and fix cycle, and then we're continuously reviewing it according to quality and success criteria that we would need to see to be able to release to the exchange.
Question. Before we move from this slide, sometimes terminology is important, and sometimes what the meaning of that terminology is important in defining it. I have heard slightly, not just from your testimony, but from other previous testimony and other previous discussions, different definitions of the go, no-go. At some times, I've been given the impression that this is whether the system is able to go live in the sense that the testing is successful, and then on a much wider range that we might consider other options. What is the meaning in here of go, no-go? I mean, what are you actually trying to communicate to the committee in the slide, of course?
The go, no-go in the March timeframe, if the system is not available for individuals and community partners and agents by the March timeframe, we would very likely make the decision we would favor our hybrid process, which currently is allowing us to get enrollments, and we have already begun the due diligence around assessing alternatives for how we would bring up a viable exchange past the open enrollment period.
How broad are those alternatives?
We are in the process of assessing any breadth of alternatives that you can think of.
Okay. I have one thing that hasn't failed at my age is imagination, and so Representative Vega Peterson and then Representative Harker.
So just a couple of questions also about this chart. First of all, the tribal eligibility, I remember hearing in November that was going to be pulled out completely until some of these other things are online, but it looks like it's listed as the go, no-go decision point. Which one is the case?
Co-Chair Vega Peterson, we are actually in test with tribal as part of the system improvements that we are releasing. Tribal would be part of those. They're not in the second and third phases. We have put those in with the full individual launch.
Okay, great. And follow up.
Well,
yes, I'm the chair. So you have several months of tests, right? From November to current, you're looking at we're in test mode for several of these components that have to do with the go, no-go decision. I understand that you do the cyclical testing. So you test, and then you fix, and then you go back and you test again. But can you talk a little bit about some of the, and you can get a little technical here, but go some of the roadblocks that you're running into. Are there certain problems or sticking points that you're finding as you're going through the testing cycle?
Co-Chair Vega Peterson, some of the major sticking points that we're seeing right now is being able to go through an application and track, put the information in, track all the way through to an eligibility determination, take that eligibility determination and make a plan selection with it, and then choose an enrollment. As we go through the tests, what we'll find is, depending on the complexity of a household or a specific circumstance, we'll end up having an issue with our eligibility being taken, and we need to. It's where we get some of the complexity in the system is actually in that multiple groups can shop within a household. And so as you take those our eligibility system takes and breaks everybody out into the right groups that's most advantageous for eligibility, and then getting that into the next shopping phase and making sure that that's accurate has proven to be quite complex, and that's been an area where it's taken a lot of these test and fix cycles. And then as you get through that shopping phase, at the very end of that application, you have to make sure that the logic around signatures is working correctly, because there are a lot of rules around who can sign for the different groups of the plan. So if you have one shopping group went through and did a qualified health plan, another was Medicaid, so they basically are eligible, and that's the end there. And you may have two separate people who need to sign, but of course those people can't be under the age of 18 unless they have a child, and you go through all those little nuances and preparing those signatures to be accurate. Those are the type of challenges that we've found in the system. Previous to this time, and the last time that I provided an update, we were having challenges with performance as well. We believe that we've overcome those challenges. We've been able to hit our criteria for the number of users who can be on the system. So now where we really are making sure that those more complex scenarios and that those scenarios work well within the system.
Thank you. Okay.
Representative Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi. Thanks for being with us here today. This test and fix methodology, would that fall under a particular development title?
Co-chairs, Representative Parker. If you mean development methodology, mm-hmm. The methodology that we are following at this point is an iterative methodology, although we have
almost sounds like an agile methodology.
It is not an agile methodology in that we are not introducing new requirements in each of the. It's not a where it differs from agile, and I see where you're going, but where it differs from agile is that we're not reviewing the system, seeing something that gave us a new idea, building those requirements, having them implement that, and then looking at it again. This is literally, we have a set number of requirements that we're trying to achieve, and the tests and the fixes, the development team is putting in proposed fixes. We're spending a significant amount of time to regression test and to do all the testing that we need to do, and then we either reject or we fail based on that fixed requirement. So that's where it's iterative in nature in terms of the test and fix, but it's not agile in terms of us continuing to introduce new requirements into the development process.
Thank you. Follow up?
Yes.
One of the things that Carolyn Lawson, who was, of course, associated with this project before, has been roundly criticized for in the press is the use of the agile methodology. At what point was that abandoned and switched to what is this non-agile methodology that's being used?
Co-chairs, Representative Parker, around the beginning of 2013, we reassessed the development method and began to use, we actually called them iterations, so mm-hmm. we called it an iterative development methodology where we were building our requirements at the beginning of those iterations with the idea that we would build out a full requirement set and then iterate the development releases on that fixed requirement set. I do want to be very clear, though, also to say that as time went on, we had change management around requirements, and we did, as the federal government, for example, brought in new IRS requirements, we had to implement those into each of our two-month release cycles, et cetera, et cetera. But we had our scope primarily set at that point, and we were attempting to develop releases off of that base scope.
Yeah, it's always interesting developing with the feds as a partner. During the earlier period that you just described, who owned the specs? Who were the scrum masters? And you don't have to provide this info to us right here, right now, but I would like to know at the time that this started moving through Cover Oregon's domain, who was the project owner? Who were scrum masters?
Okay.
Okay. Thanks.
Senator Olson, and then I'm going to actually ask the committee's indulgence to let you go for about another 8-9 minutes. You can get through your presentation, then we'll go to a few questions, so I can probably finish this in my earlier estimate of 45 minutes. So,
thank you. Since we have a nice graph up there for September to the current, to me, in my industry, this would indicate a cost overrun. And if we have a cost overrun, how are we paying for this? And is Oracle being paid to fix these mistakes that I would think that maybe they originally made?
Co-chairs, Senator Olson, at this point, we are withholding payment for the development activities that that Oracle is involved in. We have outside legal counsel that are providing us guidance for how to proceed with this. At this point also, we are not sitting in a cost overrun, even considering the amount that we have withheld from Oracle for their development activities.
One follow-up, please.
Yes.
I have a document in front of me that says that stated that we can't hold Oracle to their contract because we have production problems. We have a contract with Oracle that's based on a system-level agreement that have production uptime. Another gentleman said the bottom line was that there was supposed to be a process to go to production ready state, and because we didn't follow that, we can't hold them accountable for not going through that process. So are we not holding Oracle accountable for this process?
Co-chairs, Senator Olson, we are both partnering with Oracle and holding them accountable right now. The fact is that Oracle is on site. They continue to be on site. They're developing against a system. The production readiness statement that I believe probably came out of a QA report, that refers to a very technical process around service level agreements, and the service level agreements will ultimately allow us to measure the system and ensure that it's meeting our tolerances. But quite frankly, with the system not fully released, It would have been too soon to try to move into a production readiness type of phase. We need to get the system released, and we are very interested in getting in. And again, production readiness is a term that Oracle uses as part of contract language. I do not want to leave the committee thinking that what we are implementing is not of production capacity.
Further in this paper I have, it says Cover Oregon doesn't have the level of technical staff on board to meet the steps, as stated by your own staff. Do you now have the staff available that can meet the technical steps?
Co-chairs, Senator Olson, we've taken several management actions in the last 8 weeks, and actually before that, but in the last 8 weeks we brought in additional expertise to assist us with both at the for the processes for releasing the technology, as well as expertise within the technology itself. In addition, we've also partnered with firms to help us not only with the alternatives analysis that I've described earlier, but also in helping us to review how we're approaching our project planning, our development and release cycles, and other project activities to ensure that we're staffed at a level and ensure that we're doing the right thing in terms of how the development is proceeding. We have also reached out to outside Oregon companies as well to and have had meetings to get their input and validation of our go forward processes.
Thank you, sir.
Now let's take about 8 or 9 minutes and try to get through this, and then we'll have a couple of questions at the end.
Great. So the next slide is just a continuation of how the system functions are laid out. And as you can see, for our federal and banking interfaces, those have been deployed. We've been using them for several months at this point. They support the hybrid process and are one of the major reasons that we've been able to achieve the enrollment numbers that we have to date. And we're continuing to work on additional back-end systems in support of not only the hybrid process that is currently in place, but also the full individual launch. In those areas, the areas of test within the have to do with the financial management processes, and we are testing those. We're ultimately looking to release those at the same time as the ones in the previous slide to support the front end processes. Those are the remaining back end processes that we would need to release by the March timeframe. So earlier on when I opened, I talked about correcting deficiencies and what these numbers mean. Again, these are not all deficiencies in the system, and this chart basically what I wanted to show with the chart is that over the course of this month that we've begun to clear a lot of the quality issues with the system in terms of critical defects. The line shows both functional and non-functional defects that are still remaining in the system, and the next slide will actually break those out by number, and you'll be able to see which are which. Functional are defined as those are the parts of the system that people are actually interacting with.
Sorry, very quick question.
Yes.
Total existing bugs or new bugs found?
Co-chairs, Representative Parker. These are those would be new bugs found at any particular time, with the caveat that we are now at the point at where our critical defects are they're oscillating between 8 and 13. So what this means is this is not like a punch list where you have a house and you're going to move in and you have a dent in the wall, you fix that dent and the dent's gone. This is as you're following that test fix process, these are either sticky bugs that we haven't been able to clear, or they could be a new one. It's a mix, actually.
Please proceed.
This slide actually breaks out the outstanding deficiencies in terms of releasing for a full individual launch. They, as you can see, we currently have eight total functional deficiencies that are either in the development or the test phase. The other thing I want to kind of describe as part of that cycle that I presented is as they've been fixed, they come off this page. So as you'll see, this number will go up and down depending on how the test cycles have been achieved. We have five non-functional deficiencies in place right now that are either in development or test. Most of those are actually in performance. What I also mentioned earlier, and this is where it gets a little bit tricky to assess where you are in the status of a system, but we are meeting our success criteria for performance. Even though these are critical areas that we would expect to be fixed, we have achieved our goals. Nonetheless, those will be resolved as critical defects. So I talked about when would we be comfortable with releasing the system to either the community partners and agents or individuals. And we have a criteria for system viability that is fairly extensive. And we review those criteria on a very regular basis as we're making system improvements. And we have been releasing system improvements into the production environment over time. But the decision is two-part. It is when do you release it, both from the technical perspective, and when would you be comfortable releasing that system to the users, ultimately the people who would use the system. We have broken the criteria for system viability into technical criteria, security criteria, interface criteria, and functional criteria. I'll just provide a couple examples of what those are. I'm not going to go into them exhaustively. So as you see at the very top row, one of the technical criteria that we have is that our system would be able to handle 10,000 concurrent users prior to moving it to a production-ready state, as one example. You have other security criteria. You have interface criteria, and this is split out by the different large interface areas. And as I had mentioned earlier, we've actually released a lot of our interfaces on the back end. And the next series of slides actually get into the functional criteria, which is the part of the system that that ultimately the users of the system would interact with. So you can see clearly that, for example, we have very specific requirements around at the high level around creating accounts, being able to retrieve usernames and passwords for account management. As you get into CPAs, that community partners and agents, that they be able to access a dashboard, be able to perform other functions. As you get into eligibility, it talks about the eligibility criteria, and this again is for the remaining eligibility functions that we haven't released, because we actually have a lot of those in the green status where we're actually using them today. And as you go through the other criteria, you'll see how we're measuring progress.
Great. And then to conclude, we were asked to give a brief overview of our financial status, and we have a couple of slides to do that. The first slide is an overview of our funding. And just as a reminder, Cover Oregon is funded by federal grants entirely through the end of this calendar year, 2014. We did start, per our legislation, assessing a fee based on plans sold through the exchange in 2014, this year. So we began charging an assessment on commercial lives sold through Cover Oregon. These are the private insurance lives, as well as an assessment on the public programs sold through Cover Oregon. These 2014 assessments and administrative charges establish a working capital and operating reserve for future sustainability, and has always been part of our business plan. Beginning in 2015, Cover Oregon must be self-sustaining on our own revenues. That's a combination of our reserve funding and then the continuing assessments and administrative charges that are our revenue streams. The next slide shows our federal grant balances as of December 31st of 2013. Cover Oregon has received 3 federal grants to fund our work. The first 2 have been completed. The final grant, our Establishment Level 2 grant, which is currently our funding, we still have a balance of just over $90 million. That's the funding we will use to get us through the end of this year. Just a couple of notes about this. These dollars include the unpaid development costs that Aaron mentioned. These are the dollars that we are not paying Oracle right now for the development work that they're doing, that total almost $38 million. That includes the 5% contractual holdback that we have in our contract with Oracle, as well as an additional over $36 million that's unpaid for performance issues. And then the final slide shows a snapshot of our actual expenses for 2013 and our projected budget for 2014. And with that, Aaron and I would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Representative Thatcher.
Yes, thank you. I remember some of the discussions about the self-sustaining, the quasi-public agency or corporation, I guess, that is Cover Oregon. And the fees, I thought, were going to be starting a little bit later, but nonetheless, they're in now. How much are those fees? Does it vary per carrier, or is it the same?
Co-chairs, Representative Thatcher, the fees are set through Cover Oregon by administrative rule. There is one fee that is assessed on what are called qualified health plans, or those private insurance plans. It's the same regardless of the carrier. It's set currently at $9.38. We also have an assessment per our statute on the Medicaid, the public program lives, Medicaid, Oregon Health Plan, and Healthy Kids. And that fee is about $6 per life. $6 and change. I don't remember the exact amount. We can get that for you.
And I guess a follow-up. Yeah. I was just wondering if you anticipate that going up much to keep you operational in 2015.
Co-chairs, Representative Thatcher, we just had a meeting of our board's finance committee last week in which we walked through that exact question. We have been looking at what our administrative fees would be for 2015. At this point, we believe we have developed a budget that is sustainable over time for 2015 that allows us to continue operations based on our projected enrollments and keeping the assessments at basically their same level plus a small inflationary charge of 3%. So that brings those, and these are proposed fees because we have to go through a rulemaking process at about $9.60 something cents per life for the commercial market and then the $6 and change for the public programs. But what we can do is send you that information that we went over with our finance committee last week, and it has it all laid out.
It sounds like it largely depends upon your projected enrollment actually coming to fruition. And I guess, is there a plan B? You don't have to explain it, but I just, you know.
Yeah, co-chairs, Representative Thatcher, we set our proposed budget for 2015 based on the lowest levels that we've projected that we will get in terms of enrollments through Cover Oregon. So we will be looking at how our enrollments go through the course of this year. That's enrollments during this open enrollment period plus the enrollments that we get during next fall's open enrollment period.
Okay. Representative Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I continue to believe that the most important criteria associated with Cover Oregon are the number of people to whom we provide insurance, hopefully in an affordable manner, particularly those who were unable to attain it before. And we continue to hear good stories about that. But I have to tell you that the IT problems associated with this and the manners in which we have been receiving and not receiving information drive me crazy. All right. I'm really looking forward to continuing the discussions, and I want to have some fairly detailed discussions about that, and I think this committee is the place to have those. One thing that would help me sort through some things along the timeline of when things started to go south and who was where when are minutes to the meetings that were jointly held by the HICS IT project and Oracle and Cover Oregon. So if you could provide those minutes to this committee, that would be great. Thanks.
I have some actual follow-up questions. I'm not going to ask them all now. I'll actually have some of them sent to you for the next meeting. First question is relatively straightforward. Most people in the outside do not know that a portion of the system is operational that agents have been using and some of the other people have been trained out in the field to actually enroll people. That system was operational in a satisfactory manner but had some limitations. My understanding is you did an upgrade to that system, so the system was down. Is the system back up, and when did it go back up?
Co-Chair Devlin, the system is we currently have not brought it back up to the agents and community partners. We're continuing some testing. We will have some improvements when we bring the system back up.
Okay. The agents and community partners were told that we'd be down for 2 to 3 days, probably. No guarantees, but probably. How long has it been down now?
We brought the system down for agents and community partners last Friday.
Okay. So it's been down a week.
That's correct.
Okay. The other questions are a little bit more pressing, and I don't mean them to be as strident as they sound. The legislature exists in actually an atmosphere of rumors. And rumors are sometimes true, and sometimes they're just rumors. Is the board of Cover Oregon considering at any time in the foreseeable future canceling the contracts they have for quality assurance and other functions from Maximus?
Co-Chair Devlin, at this point, we are not planning on canceling any of the contracts for quality assurance.
Or any of the other functions.
Or any of the other functions, that's correct.
The reports that you get back in terms of the quality assurance and quality control, how are those being shared with the Department of Administrative Services, the IT division there, with LFO, with your partners at OHA? One of the things I think Representative Harker brought it up and others have is the communication. And actually, to be honest, to be able to see those quality assurance reports and get reports back from parties independent from Cover Oregon, not implying any, is actually probably beneficial to your case. So how is that being communicated to other entities?
Co-Chair Devlin, you brought up Department of Administrative Services as well as the LFO. We share those reports as we get them with both of those entities.
Okay. This co-chair will probably have some other questions. They'll be in writing, and I believe the other co-chair will also, and members, please feel free to contact either of us or Aaron so we can get some questions in prior to your next meeting.
Great.
Any follow-ups? Thank you very much for appearing here today. And now, if Representative Gorsuch would please join us, we will move on to our next item. Gina, if you'll come forward.
Ms. Blackmere.
And I say Gina because I always refer to her that way because she was one of my favorite members of the Legislative Council staff. And now she's went on to an okay entity, at least not the Department of Administrative Services. So if you would begin at your leisure, and for the sake of the record, this is a report from the Oregon Audits Division of the Secretary of State.
Co-Chair Devlin, Co-Chair Vega Peterson, my name is Gina Zedlick. I am Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Kate Brown. I am here today to introduce our auditors to you. I actually met Gary Blackmer, the Director of Audits, when I was in Council, and even then he changed my mind about what audits are and that it's not just something you don't want the IRS to do to you. And so of course, we do financial audits, and that is a core function of our audits division. We also do performance audits, which is what we're here today to update you on. And these performance audits are also vital to the efficiency of our state government. So the other thing to note about audits is that I've learned that they are not all bad news. They are they do find problems. But they also offer solutions and make recommendations. And in about 80% of the cases that we do, the agencies respond very positively and take on take the recommendations to heart and implement them. So with that, we really appreciate the opportunity to be here in front of you today and give you some more information on the audits that we've done in this past year.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the audits director in the Secretary of State's office. What I'd like to do is introduce a few other people that helped in these audits. I brought them along to answer the difficult questions. I can answer some of the general ones. To my right is Will Garber, the deputy director of performance audit. And behind me, we have Sharon Blasey, who's one of our audit managers, and Olivia Riquet, one of our senior auditors. So this started with House Bill 3316. We were requested by the legislature to examine the TriMet Transit District and specific aspects we are asked to look at were the immediate and long-term operational structure, practices, and functions of the district, the transparency of district operations, practices, and functions, the immediate and long-term fiscal condition of the district, and compliance with state and federal laws generally. This was a very large undertaking with a January 30th deadline, and so we assembled a team and began work on that. And what I'd like to do is turn it over to Will Garber, who will give you kind of a walkthrough of what the audit is about, and then we can answer questions at that time about that audit. And then I can give you a very quick summary of four other audits that we have issued since then as well that you may not have heard about, and answer any questions about those.
Please proceed. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Will Garber. As Gary mentioned, the scope of this audit was quite broad. We conducted a lot of interviews to pull it off, reviewed a lot of policies and procedures. We interviewed management. We interviewed frontline staff. In fact, conducted interviews with 78 frontline staff members. We covered quite a lot of ground, so I'm just going to cover the highlights here. I'll talk first about governance and management. TriMet has a 7-member board. We saw that they were actively involved in a lot of different issues, including fair and transfer policies, financial strategies, served on advisory committees, and had a role in engaging stakeholders. We saw that TriMet had a number of plans to guide the agency. It has a 5-year action plan that sets agency budgets and priorities. And I have to say that's something we don't always see with every agency we audit. But there were a number of other plans, too, that they rely on. They have a strategic financial plan they're starting to work on, a capital asset management plan, and a safety plan. We saw that managers review monthly performance reports to identify issues that need to be followed up on. We also saw that TriMet has an internal audit department that reviews various issues. Things like preventative maintenance and contract compliance are recent topics they took on. So we had a couple different recommendations in this area. One was for TriMet to consider implementing a hotline for employees to be able to report fraud, waste, or abuse of district resources. And we also suggested that they publish the results of their internal and external reviews and audits on their website. Those things are available by request, but we thought it would make sense to make them a little bit more accessible. The next area we looked at was financial condition, and this is an area where TriMet definitely has some challenges. The recession cut into revenues, and in response, TriMet did some things like increased fares, reduced service, delayed vehicle replacements, delayed some maintenance. So they weathered that storm, but TriMet still has a $1.1 billion unfunded retiree health care and benefit liabilities. The biggest portion of that is health benefits for current and future retirees. The balance is for retirees in the defined benefit pension plans, which have now been closed. TriMet's currently paying down the pension liabilities, but is not at this time paying down the health benefit liabilities. TriMet has taken some actions to address these financial issues. It's closed the defined benefit pension plan I mentioned, increased the retirement age some. It's also asked employees to begin sharing in medical costs. The TriMet and its board have also started developing a strategic financial plan. That plan would be paying down the pension in 15 to 20 years, and it would reduce the medical benefit liabilities by 50%. So the recommendation we had in this area was for TriMet to include a specific strategy for addressing the medical and pension liabilities in that strategic financial plan that it's working on. The next area that I'll talk about is labor management relations. This is another area where TriMet has some challenges. We found that strained relations between management and the union are negatively affecting the organization. Negotiations over the last contract, for example, took several years. Both sides aired their views in the press, and that had impacts on TriMet's relationship with frontline employees, including their morale. We noted that there's really little communication between TriMet management and the union outside of labor negotiations, and that's despite some provisions in the contract that call for those kinds of meetings. We also heard from both management and frontline employees that internal communication needs to be improved. It's not easy with TriMet. They've got 1,200 employees that report to duty in 5 different stations. But we did hear from frontline employees that there's little communication between operators and supervisors, limited opportunity to provide feedback on things like safety, vehicles, and routes. And frontline employees are often unclear about the basis for management decisions. TriMet knows it needs to work on these issues. It's acknowledged that. It's drafted a communications plan. We saw that that plan is really focused more on disseminating information than it is two-way communication. So our recommendations in this area kind of address some of those issues I've just raised. We suggested that TriMet hold formal meetings with the union outside of contract negotiations to address financial and operational issues, try to identify some strategies for improving two-way communication and the relationship between management and frontline employees, and consider some strategies other transit agencies have used to better communicate and engage with employees. The next area I'll talk about is external communication and relations. We thought TriMet saw that TriMet many efforts underway to inform and engage and collaborate with external parties. They do public surveys. They seek public comments on route and fare changes, and they have committees that include public participants. We had 3 recommendations in this area. One was for TriMet to communicate to participants how their input affected the decision. We talked to some external parties that appreciated TriMet reaching out but didn't feel like they knew what TriMet did with the information they provided them. We also suggested that TriMet conduct its attitude and awareness survey every year to better track service satisfaction. This is something that is done in the past. We saw a 2-year gap in that survey, and that was a time when non-rider satisfaction with TriMet went down quite a bit, so we thought it made sense to continue that survey every year. And we also recommend that TriMet have the accountability committee solicit feedback on additional information that might be of interest to the public. Next area that we looked at is managing operations. We saw that TriMet takes considerable effort to plan and assess routes and schedule operators, use ridership data, forecasts of underserved areas and community outreach to assess routes, use computer programs to translate routes into work shifts. But we also heard from some operators that schedules aren't realistic and that they feel pressure to skip lunches and bathroom breaks just to stay on time. We saw that scheduling operators is complex. This is something that happens 4 times a year in 2-week stints, so it requires a lot of resources and time. We saw that TriMet took reasonable efforts to maintain its fleet by doing things like regular inspections and service, but we also noted that TriMet's a little bit behind on maintaining its MAX infrastructure, signals and tracks in particular. TriMet also has reorganized its executive team to try and better address maintenance and provide more reliable service. Our recommendations in this area,
We have one question, sure. Senator Olson.
It was pretty, very public, I should say, the overtime that some of these drivers were getting. And I noticed on your report that some of these guys are driving over 14 hours. Did you address that for safety reasons? I mean, that seems to be a lot of hours for a driver to be operating.
Co-Chair Devlin, Senator Olson, yeah, in fact, that's an area I was going to get into a little bit later, but I'll jump to it.
Okay, well, no, if you're going to get to it, that's fine. I just want to make sure we covered that.
Sure, let me do that and then, you know, ask the question then. Let's see, where were we? So the recommendations in the managing operations area were for TriMet to formally adopt some guidelines to ensure consistency in how it identifies its route and services, re-examine its processes for setting work shifts to ensure there's adequate time for breaks, work with operators about the adequacy of bathroom facilities. We heard there were concerns about safety, availability, cleanliness of bathroom facilities, to consider improving the method for receiving scheduling feedback from operators, and to continue working with the union to reduce the complexity and cost of bus operator signups. The next area I'll talk about is hiring, training, and evaluations. Hiring efforts seemed pretty reasonable, but we did note that there may be some barriers to that would discourage experienced maintenance people from applying. And in particular, according to the labor contract, an experienced mechanic outside of TriMet would have to start in a low-level service position, such as cleaning buses, and work his or her way up before they could actually be in a mechanics position at TriMet. TriMet provides extensive training, observation, and feedback to new operators. On the other hand, we heard that evaluations of frontline employees are pretty limited and don't provide a clear picture of how they are doing. And other frontline staff don't receive any formal evaluation at all. So our recommendations here were for TriMet to continue to work with the union to allow for applicants with prior maintenance experience, consider formally documenting its bus operator recertification program. That's something that it has for current operators, and it has procedures for doing that. They're just not formal now. That's what we're recommending. And to continue developing a formal evaluation process for all frontline employees. So the last area that I have to talk about is safety. We noted that since the 2010 bus accident, some of you may be familiar with, and which resulted in two fatalities and some other injuries, TriMet did take a number of actions to kind of improve safety. That includes reviewing and revising its safety policies and practices, elevating the safety manager to an executive position that reports directly to the general manager, implementing an online system for reporting safety concerns that bus operators and other employees can use, and forming a safety task force and establishing various safety committees that frontline employees and management serve on. But there's also some indications that TriMet can improve in the area of safety. Some frontline employees don't believe that the safety committees are effective, and some are reluctant to use that online reporting system. They just don't have confidence that management's going to do anything with the reports. And we also, this gets to the question that was asked earlier, we also understand that TriMet's been working with the union to revise its hours of service policy. Right now, I believe the formal policy would allow allows operators to work as many as 17 hours in a day. TriMet has kind of worked on a temporary agreement with the union that just covers bus operators, which sets a little bit more limits on hours worked. But that, as I mentioned, only applies to bus operators, not all employees in safety-sensitive positions, and it's just a temporary agreement at this point that would need to be settled in the labor contract.
Let me add to that. TriMet was tracking the number of drivers that worked more than the 14 hours, and there were 590 instances out of 259,000 shifts between October 2012 and September 2013. But they are concerned about that as well, and they're working on that.
Well, I would think that would be a safety issue. I mean, semi-truck drivers can't drive like that, and they're the only person. You've got a busload of people, and you're driving them around, and you've been out there 16, 17 hours. Not only are the people on the bus at risk, but also the people that are walking on the street, as we well know. And I would think that would be something that they would diligently work at to cut those hours back. Besides that, it saves money. When you're paying overtime, that gets very expensive.
Chair Devlin, Senator Wilson, I agree that there are more strict guidelines for the rail operations than there are for bus in terms of the number of hours, and we point that out. We're not defending the 14 hours. I would want to point out, though, that the cost of overtime versus hiring an additional employee has gotten closer and closer to being about the same amount as healthcare costs increase and the costs of training and vacation and other leaves are added in. So it's not to excuse the fact that there are safety risks with more overtime, but overtime is becoming less and less of an expensive comparator to hiring an additional employee.
Yeah, they do have probably one of the most lucrative healthcare systems in our state to start with. And looking at one of your charts there, it looks like only 22% of their fares, or 22% of their revenue is generated by fares, which means that we, the taxpayers, have to subsidize the rest of it. And, if we hire more employees, I think safety would be tantamount to anything.
And, you know, if we have to put some more people on so these guys aren't driving 17 hours a day or 14 hours a day, I think that, and I realize that is not your responsibility. It should be TriMet's. But I'd like it on the record that they need to take a look at that, and they really should be serious about it.
Co-Chair Devlin, Senator Olson, I just add one thing, too, that the number of hours an operator works is an item that's subject to the labor contract.
One thing I might actually put on the record here is that during this short session, the co-chair and I reviewed the agenda for the month, and given some pressing issues on the IT side, there's not very much in our 4 weeks on the audit side. That it may not be the case after the short session, and there may be some opportunities actually to bring up some agencies, even some outside agencies, to get their responses to your audit, even though we have some of those in writing. So we might have that opportunity with TriMet sometime in the future. So, yes, Representative Thatcher.
Excuse me. You may not have covered this in your audit, and, you know, that's fine. But I was just curious if the max lines, there are more and more max lines, more track being set for, you know, max lines. I'm just wondering, does that impact the number of buses available or, you know, the number of drivers that are hired? Are there being people being laid off because of more max lines coming in? I'm just wondering, because it seems like that would substitute for the max would substitute for many of the buses, and I'm wondering if it's impacting that as well, and also shifting funds budget from what has been traditionally mostly just buses to more max line.
Co-Chair Devlin, Representative Thatcher, I don't have a precise answer to your question. I know that TriMet tries to think about you know, the total picture in terms of, you know, meeting demand with both buses and max lines. I know that max lines are funded heavily with federal money. And I'm sorry, Gary, what were you?
I was going to add to this that the actual cost per ride for the max line is a little more than half of what it is for a bus, that the operating costs for it, the construction costs, are definitely upfront cost that, you know, as Will Garber noted, are paid with a portion of federal dollars. But the actual cost per ride for a bus in 2013 was about $4, and then for the light rail line, it was a little over $2 per ride.
Steve. Okay. Yes, did you have any question? No. Representative Gorsuch, did you have any questions?
No, I have some testimony, but the only question that that I can think of at the present time would be the question of governance. And I did read the audit. I also read TriMet's response. And the one thing that I was hoping for was perhaps a little more in-depth analysis of that. Now, given the fact that it's a short timeline, I understand that, but was there any way that you had the time to look at various types of governance models for similar-sized agencies across the country?
Co-chairs, Representative Gorsuch, we did look to see what kinds of models were out there, and there were a variety where some, you know, were appointed by a governor or, you know, by locally elected officials or even, you know, elected type of a thing. And those are particularly difficult questions for we auditors to answer because there really are a policy issue of, you know, representation, responsiveness, accountability, and those are all, you know, elements that we as auditors we're better at numbers and management issues than we are at, you know, the representation. So since we didn't see any clear and obvious, you know,
model that stood out, and we did see transatlantic districts and other places struggle as well in terms of those very things, management, accountability, transparency. We didn't see one that seemed to be a clear, you know, head and shoulders above any other model, and we decided that we didn't know enough to report on a, on it that way.
So in the, Mr. Chair,
yeah.
So there's no, there's apparently no kind of best practices out there in terms of that sort of thing where you could look and say, oh, this model seems to be preferred over.
Co-chairs, Representative Gorsuch, no, nothing stood out that we could see.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Black.
I have one question about, I have a number of questions about the TriMet audit, but I want to dig just briefly into another issue, and that's the issue of the relationship between management and the actual, the workers in TriMet. There used to be a representative here who had been an operator for TriMet many years ago. And he described a circumstance where the relationship was so bad between the people out in the field and management that when he was driving on Skyline Boulevard in the northwest area of Portland, where ice is often an issue, he couldn't take the bus back to the garage to put chains on it until a supervisor came because they didn't trust the operator to make that judgment on whether. This is 20-some years ago. Just how bad is the sort of internal morale? I mean, you were there. You interviewed so many people. How bad is it? I mean, if you could quantify it, I don't expect you to quantify it. But.
Co-Chair Devlin, yeah, I don't think I could quantify it. I mean, I do think that that is a challenge that TriMet faces. They know it. They know that relationships between management and frontline employees are not good. And that was our perception, too, based on the interviews we did and the time we spent there.
Chair Devlin, if I could add, I think there's lots of opportunities for them to be more engaged with the operators on the problems that they encounter in their work. And I think that's an avenue where they really need to work. The other side of it, which is the difficult challenge they have in dealing with their unfunded liability with their health care benefits, is going to be... it's going to make it hard for them to build a strong, positive relationship because they're needing to take benefits away in order to reach some basis. And it is an extremely generous health system, yeah, with operators getting full benefits, although under the new contract, which is still under appeal, I should say, it would go down and they share some of the cost, but it goes for the rest of their life for that level of benefits, mm-hmm, and their spouse for 16 years after the operator dies. So it's something that there is a very long tail, as the actuaries will say, to the cost of this, and that's why it's like $840 million of unfunded liability.
Mm-hmm. We should probably get to your other audits and... thank you very much. If you'd like to stay,
more of it.
Oh, that's okay.
Or if you had any future interest, actually.
I did have...
Oh, yes, okay.
Yeah, if you have time, I
yes,
did have
okay.
a statement, too. So.
Yes, if you'd like to. Please proceed.
Oh, okay. Well, good afternoon, Co-Chair Devlin and Vega Peterson, who's not here right now. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Chris Gorsuch. I'm the representative for District Number 49, which is out in East Multnomah County, so that encompasses Troutdale, Fairview, Wood Village, Gresham, and a little bit of Portland. As you know, I was the chief sponsor of the bill in 2013 that called for the audit that we've been discussing. I would like to make clear that in doing this audit, I was not attempting, as perhaps some people think, to take sides, you know, with either management or the transit union. My intent was to get a good, solid picture of the operations so that we can try and find a way to move forward in a more positive fashion with TriMet. And since the legislature did create TriMet back in about 1969, I believe, or 70, it seems like that's a role that we should undertake since there have been a lot of challenges there. And I do want to thank the auditors for their work. I know it was a very ambitious undertaking with a very short timeline. So I want to thank you for your work. And I do note that you found a number of challenges that face the regional transit agency. The aging rail line infrastructure, especially if you think about the blue line, which goes out into my district in East Multnomah County, being the first one, and it came online in about 1986. So there's a certain amount of upkeep, even with the rail lines, that has been a challenge for them. Although, as I noted in your audit, they appear to be working to get some new personnel to improve that operation. And as you've just been describing, we've seen communications issues that are internally quite challenging, I think, for both sides of the system, and the significant unfunded pension costs and tied in with the healthcare costs. So while those are certainly significant and definitely we need to find ways to address these, my initial question does still remain, and that is it's actually twofold. One was the one I just expressed, which was the question of governance. But the other one is whether transit decisions, which are, you know, impacting a lot of people across my particular district and across the metropolitan area, if those are being made for the correct reasons. And so, yeah, I've heard from a lot of my constituents, first as a Troutdale City Councilor and then later in my role as a state legislator, who frequently feel TriMet still doesn't listen to its riders when making decisions. Initially, there was a consideration that we would offer a different governance model. And then it became clear that what we really needed to do first was what the audit division has done, which is to get a fairly clear picture so that we can see the strengths, see the weaknesses, and work forward. Now, the recent audit does provide insight into operations and finances. It does still have some problems when it's dealing with improving transparency and accountability for transit riders themselves. And so I think we still need to, I asked the question, so this is certainly not a criticism of the auditors, but I think we do still need to find out how the appointed board compares with other governance structures, and perhaps maybe that would even be a work group sort of thing to study that. And also to see just how seriously, and I think it was touched on a little bit, how seriously the feedback from riders is taken by TriMet. I noticed that they do an extensive amount of research, and they have public meetings and a lot of different things where they bring in the feedback. It's not clear to me what happens after it goes in to the system. So that's one piece that I would like to see us continue to work on. Route assessment is an interesting one, and you cover that pretty well in the audit, where TriMet talks about how they do consistently go back and evaluate lines and work to see if, what the best practices can be. And I will admit that they did a couple of tweaks. They took the 8081 line and extended it a few blocks to the Sandy River where the local park is. And they took the 77, which is the Broadway, and sent it down to Frontage Road, which, you know, it's a good improvement. But those are really tiny tweaks. And the only substantial change to East County Service was the 21, which sent it out Sandy Boulevard and then 223rd up to the Gresham Transit MAX stations. So if that system truly works, I don't understand, and this is not for you, this is really for TriMet, I don't understand why we would continue to have such poor service in East Multnomah County. You know, the Gleason Street Corridor, which has developed a consistent amount of business and housing, the Gleason bus does not extend beyond the Rockwood Transit Station, even though there's tons of communication. And one other thing, Burnside Road, which is a huge artery in Gresham, has no bus service. So at any rate, I will stop now, and thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. I do hope that we can make the system better, and I appreciate you listening to me today. So thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. And we'll go on to the other three audits. Can you try to complete, we'll come back to those audits probably in future meetings. Can you try to complete those in about the next 10 to 12 minutes?
Chair Devlin, I can do faster.
Okay.
I'm just going to run through them very quickly. We issued an audit in August of 2013 on treatment of high-risk offenders. And we looked at prisoners who were released from prison and sent back to the community and put under supervision of community corrections officers, and looked at the kinds of alcohol and drug treatment services that were provided by the counties once they were reverted back to local responsibility. And what we found was that they had only about half of them that were the most serious offenders needing treatment were getting the services that they need, whereas about 70% of the offenders had some level of substance abuse problem. And we defined that those that needed the treatment the most as those who were medium to high risk of reoffending, committing another crime, or and having a moderate to high substance abuse challenge. So what we looked at was the cost per day of the supervision and treatment relative to the cost for incarceration in prison. And what we concluded there was that $21.6 million in savings and impact to the community could have been realized in the period from 2008 through 2011. There were 4,525 offenders of the sample that, or the of the group that we looked at, who were assessed highest risk, who were released but did not receive any treatment. So our concern was that without that kind of treatment, they were more likely to have a negative impact on the community as well as return to prison. One of the things that we did note, we noticed that the changes in Medicaid would make many of these offenders eligible back in the community for those services so that the county could provide those services at essentially federal government expense. So it would allow the county to redirect its general fund dollars elsewhere and instead provide, make sure that those services are provided with Medicaid dollars. So we recommended that the Department of Corrections, the counties, and Oregon Health Authority coordinate their efforts to ensure that as many eligible offenders as possible be enrolled and get the alcohol and drug treatment that would help keep them from returning to prison or committing other offenses in the community. We did an audit on teacher preparation. We looked at it from the standpoint of from the teaching of potential teachers by the colleges all the way through to the professional development and learning that they need to do in their first 3 to 4 years as new teachers to see how well all the organizations were working to provide the best possible teaching experience for students by creating the best possible teachers. We had a number of recommendations, and we looked at, we focused on the K through 12 students in this case. And what we found was that the Oregon teaching colleges are making efforts to strengthen student teaching, but that there is quite a bit of variance on how well they're coordinating their coursework with the student teaching experiences. They'll send student teachers out, but working with the schools in the communication and coordination and basically the help that teachers need in order to be better prepared when they start their career is an area that they need to do additional work. We also looked at performance indicators, looking at how could we measure what the teaching colleges were doing in terms of improving those future teachers, and looking at assessments that the schools might provide for the teaching colleges so they get a sense of areas that they can improve in their preparation of teachers, and made a number of recommendations in that area, and noted other states that are doing assessments that and developing information like hiring and retention data, surveying the schools, or the superintendents or administrators of the schools on the teachers that they're getting. We did conduct a survey of the administrators, and we found that only half of the respondents did not believe, or they were unsatisfied with the teaching colleges and how sufficiently they were preparing the students to enter the classroom. So we saw that as an area where more communication would benefit not only the teaching colleges and what they provide, but the teachers that come out of those colleges and enter the classroom and help them be better prepared. We also looked at the licensing requirements. Yes, sir.
Okay. With the other co-chair's indulgence, why don't you proceed, but we will skip the Office of Emergency Management today.
Okay.
Because I think that's an audit that we may want to spend some more time on, and I'm sensing that the members on the committee are getting tired, and I'd like them to be
fresh
when we go through that audit. So,
Chair Devlin, I certainly understand on a Friday afternoon. I will just say that we recommended that there be more consideration of independent assessments of the students as they're leaving the college for their ability to teach. Currently, the colleges assess the students and give them a pass or no pass, and we felt like more independence was necessary. I will skip emergency management, and let me do a one-minute advertisement for a very interesting audit we did of a GPS device that ODOT asked us to test measuring weight mileage of trucks. It's plugged into the vehicle. The prototype that we tested came out of New Zealand, and it's a GPS with a cellular communication, and it tracks the vehicle and determines how many miles it drove on a public road, and then the trucker puts in the information about the vehicle, and that's uploaded, and it produces a report that shows all the route that the truck took. And ODOT needed someone to test the security of it as well as the reliability and accuracy of it. And we found that it satisfied both of those, and we also saw that it was more accurate than the truckers having to fill out the forms manually. So it was a very interesting audit for us to look at a prototype and see if it was something that would satisfy an Oregon need, and ODOT is looking at that as one possibility for the future, but they felt like we could provide the expertise and independence to assess that. So it was a rather challenging and interesting audit for us to do. And thank you.
Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, and we'll invite you back sometime soon, hopefully.
Great.
We're going to move on to the final item on the agenda. We have actually three presentations. Mr. Baer? To come forward for E-Court. I see you're bringing Phil with you. I think the Chief Justice is preoccupied with a 100-year celebration or something.
Cake and cookies.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, I'm Phil Lemon from the State Court Administrator's Office. With me is Bryant Baer, who's our Chief Information Officer. Given your schedule and that you still have two more presentations, I think what we will do is kind of run through our overview and summary pretty quickly. We wanted to call your attention to the status of our public-facing services that the public will be experiencing as Oregon eCourt rolls out. Spend a little more time on our Multnomah County implementation. That's our next circuit court going live in May, and it's a big one and has some complexities. We want to spend a little more time with that, but we'll try to move through this pretty quickly if we can.
Okay. Please proceed.
Co-chairs, for the record, Bryant Baer, Chief Information Officer, Oregon Judicial Department. And as Phil said, I'll go through the first couple of slides very quickly. I'll focus on what we're doing with our public-facing assets and looking forward to Multnomah in May. And so one of the things that I would like to point out is we're getting ready here. is that our contract with Tyler Technologies is what's known as a deliverables-based contract, not a time and materials contract. So in our contract, we have to, once we decide what we want or it's designed by contract, the contractor delivers it, we test it, we deploy it, then they get paid. And so in a time and materials contract, which is much different, you generally get paid as you go along, they have to actually provide the product, we have to deploy it, it has to work, and then they get paid for it. So I think that was an important distinction I wanted to put out right up front. Our court implementations are on schedule, and we do remain on budget. The Odyssey case management and system has been installed in 10 courts to date, and the presentation will catch up with me if that's okay with the co-chairs. We've got 10 courts live, with our last courts going live were Benton and Polk in January. Our next go live is in Multnomah on May 12th, and as Phil mentioned, I do have a couple of more slides to talk more about in-depthly about that. What we did is we did a phased approach. We ended up doing a pilot, early adopter courts. We incorporated lessons learned, and then we slowly started moving through the state. Then we went to Jackson County. By doing that, we learned, we grew, we incorporated the lessons learned, which resulted in a steady decline in number of issues and the severity of the issues. Our data migration got better, our implementations got better, our training got better. So the slide that you have next is just a visual of the rollout schedule. As you can see, we have Multnomah in May, and you'll see in the slide extra we gave ourselves a little bit of breathing room before we get to our next courts, which are Douglas, Josephine, and Marion in December. Lane and Lincoln. 2015 becomes a very busy year for us. Lane, Lincoln, Deschutes, Klamath, and Lake are all done by the end of this biennium that we're in right now. So as it relates to our public-facing services and status, e-payment, which is where you can pay post-adjudicated fines, debts, and assessments, has been online since November 2011. We processed over $25 million in transactions. I do like to mention that that's a different way that we're getting the money from OJD or for OJD and for the state versus people mailing it in, take it to the court, that you can do that online now. So when people say $25 million, it's not necessarily new revenue. It's a new way of getting the revenue and a much more efficient way of doing the revenue from the public's perspective and from the court's perspective. E-citation, that's when OSP writes a ticket. That is now automatically integrated into our system the next day. In most times when OSP would write a ticket, it could take up to a week before it got to the court and into the system. It's now processed overnight electronically. That saves the trooper time, saves the court time, and allows folks to interact with that through the courts online the next day. We've done 110,000 cases to date since December 2011. E-file is available in all the Odyssey courts right now. We generally implement the e-filing 30 to 45 days after a court goes live. As of today, or as of Tuesday, excuse me, and starting in February 13th, we've had 5,500 electronic filings done through the system. Again, that's a more convenient way for our attorneys and partners to interact with OJD. We get it electronically. We don't have to scan it. It moves automatically into our routing queues for adjudication. I did want to mention, I'm sorry, that the e-filing, I'm off my slides. The next thing I wanted to talk about was our public-facing statuses. Our online document access for government users, our designated government users, is actually going into pilot mode next week. We wanted to do it in a very self-contained way of opening documents to our public, because we've learned from other states that when you do that too fast, you can find yourself in trouble. And so we designated several pilots. Jackson County Jail is one of them. Several other designated government users, which are going to start getting documents late next week. We're going to run that pilot for a while, about 30 days, and then we're going to start opening it up to the other designated government users. Then the next step is going online to the bar to get documents. But again, doing it slowly, methodically, with a lot of testing along the way. Online public case register of actions is currently available to subscribers of OGIN systems. We're looking at making that available to the public in late 14 via the web. The other two projects we've got online, along with our case management system, document management system, financial management system, is our jury management and interactive forms. One of the things that OJD realizes that when folks go for jury service, we need to be very precious with that time that they're giving to the courts. How we can more effectively communicate and manage that was one of the projects for the Oregon E-Court that is being scoped out and developed now. And the other one is interactive forms. Going online much like a TurboTax, although this is called TurboCourt, going online interactively answering a series of questions that then once it's done, it's confirmed and it's submitted to the court electronically. And so, for example, the City of Portland worked with Multnomah Courts to do the Family Abuse Prevention Act, which is it's not online, but they do it electronically, print it, and then send it to the court. We will be doing that electronically here very quickly. And so those are ways we're trying to better interact with ourselves, our customers, going forward. The next couple of slides concern Multnomah. So one of the things that we do with the court before it goes, 14 months before it goes live, is we have meetings, we discuss business processes, a technological assessment. Well, for Multnomah, we did that 18 months earlier instead of 14 months, just to give us some additional time. The other thing we did, as you saw from the schedule earlier, is we had generally run about every 3 months a court will go live, especially in 15, which is a very busy year for us. But after Multnomah, we left a period of 6 months just to make sure we're ironing out any of the bugs, making sure that they've got the program and the processes that they need before we go on to our next set of courts, which is Marion, Douglas, and Josephine. External integrations, we've got three major ones in play right now. The first one is a DA integration. They have a crimes database that works with OGIN right now that we're working to link up with Odyssey. Photo radar and our parking e-site. As you know, there's a lot of parking tickets that get generated in the City of Portland right now. We want to make sure that those are efficiently sent on their way to the courts, and then allow for
the city of Salem
pay.
Is pretty good too.
I would agree with that. And so we want to make sure that that's done efficiently before Odyssey goes online. So that's one of the integrations that we're working on. Parking does have a unique caseload to it. You're looking to find the owner of the vehicle, and sometimes that can be difficult. So we're working on how we get that into the Odyssey system and how it reconciles. And it's very high volume, as we discussed. Business processes have been identified, documented, and configured. What we have is SMEs, or subject matter experts, which are identified by the court. They are the primary interfaces with the Odyssey teams to make sure that we're understanding the business processes, configuring the system to handle those processes, and also the workflows. So when a document comes in, how does it electronically move through the court in the way that the court would like it to? One of the things that this committee is very aware of, as we've talked about eCourt, is we bought a commercial off-the-shelf product. But we also brought that product that was somewhat flexible at the local level and still remaining a COTS product. That was the goal of it. And so this is a good example with Multnomah, when we end up talking to the subject matter experts, and that they can do things locally still within the framework of the COTS system. It's a configuration based on DA charging practices, based on local preferences as to how cases are moved through. Jackson did some building on that. Crook Jefferson did some building on that. And as we go forward, other courts will as well. The next thing as it relates to Multnomah is we've done about 3 million conversion cases in the court so far. Multnomah itself has 10 million. 5 million parking, 5 million court cases. And so we've gone through 6 different tests with to make sure we're migrating the data appropriately, with 70 people reviewing the migrated data. So we're going to be doing an additional test, test 7. And then we're going to make sure that when the data goes over, everything we can do is done to maximize the accuracy and minimize system downtime. Because first it's got to be processed by Odyssey, and then it's got to be uploaded into Odyssey. And so we're working through that process right now. We've got 70 folks in the Multnomah Court going through, making sure the migration that's occurring is an accurate representation of what's in the OGIN system right now. Training 58 judicial officers plus 300 staff. They're going to be going through daily trainings for 6 weeks starting March 17th. And one of the things that we continue to learn as we go forward is get the training as close to the go-live as possible. And also, one of the things that we do is our OWIDO Office of Education and Training Department has put together a series of labs where the week before, staff can actually go in and use a dummied-up version of the Odyssey system to recreate what their jobs are prior to doing their jobs on a go-live. We found that very useful, and actually the Tyler clients are starting to pick that up based on what we were able to design here in the state of Oregon. So the labs are hands-on. business process training, so when they go live, staff have had an opportunity to actually interact with the system instead of it being more of a classroom style or opening up a book. But remember, we've got three simultaneous tracks going on because you've got 300 employees that you want to get trained very close to go live. So that represents a challenge, but it's being managed quite well. The nice thing about having 10 courts going live before Multnomah is you've got 10 other courts that are willing to help. Most of the courts are freeing up one or two staff folks to end up going to Multnomah for a series of 1, 2, and 3 weeks to make sure that they're there to assist the Multnomah staff as they're going live. Some of that focused on courtroom, some of that focused on what clerks do in back-end processing. So the other courts and technical support folks are going to be at Multnomah to assist them. There's also the external part. How do we talk to the attorneys? How do we talk to the public defenders, the sheriff's office, Portland police? We're doing 17-plus external presentations on what as it relates to Odyssey, what does it mean to them, how do they access the system when it goes live, what does it mean when Multnomah goes live, because there will be a small time when the system is dark as we're making sure we're validating the data conversions, as we're making sure we're getting everything together before we securely open up those doors. What does that mean for them? And so we're doing over 17 public presentations, and those are being received well from my understanding. So what are our current challenges? Well, if we have an aggressive timeline, we are working really fast to get the system done because we made the commitment to the legislature that we would be done in June of 2016, and we are on track to be done June of 2016, and we're on track to be done on budget. We start working with the courts 14 months in advance. So if you figure a court's going live, we're talking to them 14 months in advance to talk about their business processes, data migration, technical and physical. We've run across some courts that actually needed some county upgrades that can handle the new system coming in, especially related to power. Resource constraints, we're supporting two systems at the same time. I'm supporting OGEN and Odyssey as we're going forward. Multiple go-lives, as you saw from the schedule. Training and ongoing training. The worst thing you can do is put out a new product there, train, and never go back. And so we're working as an organization on how do we go back and do refresher training and to make sure we're maximizing the product. Court staff availability. When they're in training, they're doing double duty. And so that takes a lot of time, but the courts and the leadership in the courts has been very supportive of it. And I'd report that we've done very well, and the court staff have done amazing through this on the go-lives.
Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Harker.
Thank you. In the courts where you have gone live, is the reliance upon and the activity with OGEN dropping precipitously?
Co-chairs, Representative Harker, we facilitate that by turning most of OGEN off. And so there's only two people in a court that actually have access to OGEN. The rest use Odyssey. And part of that, the reason is that is data integrity. You don't want anything to happen to the prior system after conversion. So that is all locked down and shut off and only two people. What I generally hear, because I go on each go-live and I'm there for quite a while to make sure that resources are there, after about the third or fourth week, I hear I wouldn't go back. It's more friendly, it's user-based, it's mouse-based. And so the short answer, Representative, is we make sure they don't.
Good, thanks.
Thank you.
Anything additional? Okay.
Mr. Chair, one thing I would like to point out, the last item on this slide, is we do have a legislative action item this session. Bryant referred to the file and serve system where attorneys can electronically file and have their documents electronically served on the opposing party. The 2013 legislature approved a temporary increase in the statutory filing fees for cases to fund that service. We've met with the stakeholders. They're happy with that funding system, and so we're coming back and asking you to repeal the sunset and make those statutory filing fee increases permanent. The other piece of that bill is to establish clear authority for the Chief Justice to administratively set fees for use of all of our electronic systems and applications involved in this, so OGEN, our appellate system, and this new electronic case management system. We've been meeting with stakeholders since the 2013 session. We think we have an agreement on how that's going to work, but that's in the Ways and Means Committee after getting a due pass from House Judiciary. So that is just a picture of where we are now. The green courts are active, 2014. The yellow courts are ones that are coming online later this year. Blue is next calendar year, and 2016 will be the last courts and be done by the end of June.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next item up is the core system replacement. That's for the Department of Revenue. Mr. Smith, and we'll try to do these in about 10 minutes each, and I'm sorry for so many people having stayed here so long, but...
We had to deal with the snow last week.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Eric Smith. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Department of Revenue's Program Management Office, which is responsible for managing the core system replacement project. I think I can meet your 10-minute requirement. I'd just like to clarify, Co-Chair, does that include time for questions? Because I can even
probably
shorten it.
Probably, yes.
Yeah. I'll give my presentation about 5 minutes. I'll hit on some key slides and then give you time for questions if that meets your interests. So what I'll touch on then, I'll touch on the project overview just to refresh your memory about what we're doing, give you a current status of where we are with the project. I'll talk a little bit about our approach, and then I think I'll jump to the budget note and just talk about major milestones. So for the project overview, we actually started working on this in the summer of 2009, building our business case. And working with you over the last couple of sessions to secure funding. And the primary reason we wanted to replace our core systems was to avoid the risk of being able to maintain our legacy systems and maintain the revenue streams that you've charged us to maintain. We're very fortunate in the workspace that we're in as a revenue agency, though, that there are some solutions that are available that as we replace our systems with newer technology, we can improve performance. So those are the two drivers that we have in our organization with regard to replacing our systems. In our business case, we found that we could find a commercial off-the-shelf solution that was a most viable option, hands down, that had already been working in other states, and so that's what we selected to do. The graphic, which hopefully you can see better in the handout you can get online, but it's just to show that we have a phased implementation approach over 4 years where we're going to move more than 30 of our tax programs into the GenTax solution, beginning with the fall of this year and then the fall of each year, ending in 2017. So as we execute, we've secured Fast Enterprises as our vendor. They have developed a GenTax integrated tax solution and a data warehouse that we are implementing. It'll replace about two-thirds of our core systems. The estimated cost for the total project, beginning with costs that we incurred beginning in July of 2009 till the end in 2017, is about $89.9 million. $70.9 million of that is what we are estimating for our project implementation costs, implementation beginning this fall of 13, ending in the fall of 17. Included in the $89.9 million is you funded the project through bond financing, and we will be paying about $11.7 million in bond financing costs when we've made our final bond payment in November of 2024. Current project status, we have an independent QA firm that I'll touch on briefly. They have experience not only working with revenue agencies in other states, but they also have experience providing oversight for an implementation exactly like ours of a GenTax implementation in Georgia. So they in the first 4 months of our project, this is a status report for the end of January, is that the overall health of our project is green in their opinion. The schedule health is yellow, and I'll touch on that in just a moment. In terms of identification and being able to deliver on deliverables, identification of risks and managing risks, and the budget that we have to execute the project, they think those are all healthy. We also have an internal project manager who's given their assessment of the project. Their overall assessment of the project is yellow at the moment. For two reasons, schedule as well, which I'll touch on in a moment, and also budget. We have a meeting with our subcommittee of Joint Ways and Means next Tuesday to continue to reschedule funding through the rest of this biennium. If that goes well and we get funding, that will turn to green and we'll be fine for the rest of the biennium. Yellow means we just need to pay attention. It doesn't mean we're behind schedule. We're early in our implementation of our first rollout, and there are a number of things that we're still discovering that we have to do, especially with our legacy systems. When you bring in a new system, you need to make sure that you're tying your legacy systems to the new system and then shutting down the portions of your legacy system that you no longer need, and do that over phases. And so between now and the middle of April, the reason why I, as the sponsor, am saying we're cautious about saying where we are with regard to schedule health is just that we're still developing our schedule. We've made a lot of progress to that, and we have elements of the schedule we can manage to, but we're by the time we get to mid-April, we'll know everything that we think we need to know to be more confident about where we are in terms of implementation and handling our legacy schedule or legacy systems adjustments. A lot of things are falling into place nicely, though.
Representative Harper has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very briefly.
Sure.
Hopefully a brief answer. Why is scope still TBD? To be determined, I imagine.
Mr. Chair.
Scope creep, so very costly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, great question. Our scope is very well defined, and the benefit that we have of being a revenue agency where this has been implemented in 16 other states, our work is very similar to other agencies. What we're trying to do, the TBD is more of how we measure scope. How are we going to measure that we're on track, that we're getting all of our business requirements met through each rollout? So the scope is defined, our business requirements are well defined. The TBD is in how are we going to track that, and we've made a lot of progress in that, and the next time I meet with you, I'm sure we'll be able to have a reporting mechanism. So it's not that we don't know the scope, it's that we want to make sure we're tracking the scope in a manner that makes sense.
So discussion of TBC, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
To be continued?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Best I could do.
Just briefly touch on the approach, and to your point, Representative Harker, we're not intending to do any customization, and that's one of the things we can do to help manage scope, is there is a great deal of experience by other revenue agencies who've used this, who have done this successfully, and there's best practices inherent in that. So to the extent we can change our business processes and adopt what the COT solution brings out of the box, and over 90% of our business requirements are met with just configuration, that will help contain scope quite a bit. As I mentioned, Fast Enterprises is the vendor. Another thing I think is important for our project is we have a fixed price deliverables-based contract. We paid them when they installed the software and we saw it was working. It was installed in October, 2 weeks after they got here. Their next payment won't be until the fall of this year when we have completed Rollout 1, and we have accepted that the system works to deliver the functionality we need for the programs in Rollout 1, which is our corporate and tobacco tax programs. Once it goes live, then they will get their next payment. And also a phased approach. We're starting with more mid-size and small programs. We're learning from that. Our next rollout will be personal income tax, which has a lot of volume in terms of the number of taxpayers. And then the next rollout will have withholding, which has a lot of the revenues. I touched on that. Briefly, we had a budget note, House Bill 5008-A, which is what funded us for the project. The three requirements in that were that we work closely with DAS, which we have done. They've approved of our business case. They've also been very helpful in helping us get our QA strategy in place and getting our QA vendor and the contract in place. We had some requirements to submit information to LFO, which we have done so timely. We had our first semi-annual report due December 1st of 2013, and then we had 11 of our key foundational project management documents that they wanted to review after they were quality control reviewed, and we provided them to those after the QC review timely on February 1st. We're required to report semi-annually to LFO, and our next report will be in July. And then the last thing I'll touch on is the major milestones. As I mentioned, this is funded through bond sales. Our first bond sale was in November, and we've received the funds from that, so that we're able to continue to fund the project. We held agency-wide kickoff meetings in November where we were able to have all the members of the agency participate, including going to our major regional field offices so they could participate. The software was installed. We've paid the first invoice. we're in right now defining what we need to do to meet our business requirements by configuring the software. So we're entering the execution phase. We're already getting ready by April. We're developing our test plans already and start testing the system, testing what we've configured. We've already identified what training needs to be done for our first rollout. About 370 people will need to be trained in the agency. We've identified the type of training that they'll need. Some people will actually need to be trained how to do their job. It's not just that they have a new tool. Their job will change with some of the modernization we're providing. So we're making sure we have the right level of training for them and have a team focused on that. And then we will provide continual updates of the project to our project management documentation. As you grow through the project, you update your project management documents so they reflect what it is you're doing to manage the project. I know that's an eye chart that shows the 4 years and the major programs that we'll be rolling out over the project, and that's my update.
Any questions? Yes, Representative Vega Peters.
Thank you, Chair. Eric, nice to see you here. I've sit on the Revenue Committee, so we have gotten some updates on this project, too. And I just wanted to say, you know, we are actually implementing policy and passing legislation that we're having to take into account this project, because it will just make implementing the changes that we want to have for good policy that much quicker and that much easier to do once this is in place. So I just wanted to share that with the committee, because there are things, you know, we're dealing with a very old and antiquated system right now, mm-hmm. And there's a lot of things that we're going to be able to do much more efficiently, you know, especially with policy-wise and reporting-wise. I think that will be helpful for this body going forward.
Okay. Thank you.
Seeing no others. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
And now if our last presenter to come forward, Ms. Richardson, Ms. King, or Ms. Coleman, and while they're coming forward, one thing I would say about both the project that was just presented and the e-court before that is, Mr. Cummings remembers this very well. For e-court, we slowed the process down quite a bit back in 2011, early 2011, and now the system is proceeding quite well in terms of its introduction. We're not out of the woods. We actually slowed down the Department of Revenue to the consternation of our revenue chairs until we were satisfied. And I think there's some degree of a learning path there that sometimes it's important to be able to slow things down and to make sure that they're being done right before they proceed. And sometimes artificial dates put you in actually harm's way. I don't know if you can read between the lines in that, but with that, Ms. Richardson, welcome back again.
Thank you. Thank you. For the record, Kate Cooper Richardson, I'm the Director of the Division of Child Support and the Oregon Child Support Program at the Department of Justice, and I have here to my right Karen Coleman, who is a member of my executive team and a longtime employee of the Department of Justice and is the project executive on this project, and Lauren King, our Chief Information Officer at the Department of Justice. We note the time, and no doubt there are romantic dinners all awaiting you with your Valentines, so we will go as quickly as we can. By way of background, just so you know, that Child Support Program is one of the top anti-poverty programs for children in the U.S., and we in Oregon have about 250,000 cases and 400,000 parties, so that's just to give you some scope. Most of our funds are passed through to families that we collect, but we also collect assigned support to reimburse state agencies like DHS and OIA. All state child support programs, so in all 50 states and territories, have to maintain a child support automated system that meets federal certification requirements. And this is more than, this is a pretty complex system. It has to enable case management, automated case action alerts, accounting and distribution, document generation, business intelligence, data exchange. And Oregon has one of the oldest systems in the nation, and with COBOL programming, you know, you've heard that before. And it's obsolete and very difficult to use. A lot in training costs just to get our folks up to speed on it. And it's also very brittle and at high risk of breakage. So our goals for modernizing, like I just said, here are the important pieces here about collecting more for families. But like I said, the risk here is almost our greatest concern about keeping the system going. And it's not the same child support program that existed in the 70s. We're much more complex, and the volume's a lot higher. So to talk a little more about the project here, we were approved in the 2013 legislature approved bonding 11Q bonds for us as well to fund this the state's portion of this project. The federal government provides two-thirds of the funding. We are going to be providing some accountability through the review of multi-agency steering committee. We've got representatives even from eCourt with us and DHS and many of our partners. We've got our partnership with the Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement. LFO, our principal IT analyst, is Bob Cummings. And then we're also working very closely in partnership with the State Chief Information Office. We will have a contracted review, quality assurance, and also a federal requirement, the independent verification validation, and that contract will be maintained not by us but by DAS, and that's a federal requirement. To make sure that this project is successful, we'll be hiring a...
If I might interrupt you for a moment, just so the committee... We've had a discussion of this, that... It's a federal requirement that the QC be maintained by another entity, DAS. That's not a requirement in all of our current operations, and it's something that I think is under discussion. You know, the agency should not necessarily be the one in control of the QC, so I just wanted to put that on the record.
We have no objection to that federal requirement, we'll see. Our integrator, we will be looking at bringing in a new system. Our business case was through a feasibility study that the federal government oversaw and required, and that will be bringing in the best of breed from three different states that have new modernized systems that have been federally certified and are showing success. We'll be bringing that in from California, pieces from Michigan, and from New Jersey, the state of New Jersey. So to ensure success, our implementation vendor will have experience in integrating systems of this size and complexity. We'll be having a project management firm with also that level of experience on projects of this size. And then our project governance structure, which I'll talk a little more here about, will be used by other states. Is very similar. We've done work in our feasibility study and since then to talk to the other states about their project governance structure and how they've managed their projects, and we've also gained a lot from their lessons learned. None of the other states that have implemented new systems have had any failures in their modernized system. And then our schedule, kind of going to your original comment there, Senator Devlin, is that it's under project control. We're not, we don't have a specific date by which we need to go live. We will go live when it's ready and working. Here's just an overview of our steering committee. Like I said, it's comprised of individuals with expertise from many different parts of state government, and the steering committee will review and advise the project management on key project deliverables and decisions. They'll give strategic decisions, directions to the system development, and they also will be evaluating risk, reviewing the budget, actuals versus deliverables, on the budget actuals and the budget projections, and on our deliverables as well. I'll hurry up so we can hand this off to Karen to talk a little more about this. Here's the project management structure, and this is a collaborative effort. We know we don't have the expertise in-house to do a project of this size. And so this shows you a little bit how the state and the contractor and the other offices, LFO, CIO's office, work together to provide some structure to this project. And Karen Coleman is identified there right in the middle, will be our state person kind of coordinating the eye of the storm, perhaps, coordinating all those relationships, and is on my executive team and reports directly to me as the project sponsor. And I'm going to hand it off to her just to quickly go over where we are to date. We're very early in comparison to the other projects you've already heard from.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, as Kate stated, I am Karen Coleman, and I want to give you a brief overview of the segments of the project. As Kate noted, we were required federally to conduct a feasibility study to help determine the best modernization approach for Oregon. That project has been completed, and the feasibility study approved by the federal office. That became our business case for...
I'm sorry. Representative Harker had a question, and I don't know if this was...
Sorry. Thank you. Previous slide.
Okay.
What is the relationship of the Chief Information Officer of the state to this project?
Lauren, would you like to? I think that
best. Out there.
It's floating.
Might be a nebula.
Sure. Thank you, Co-Chair Devlin, Representative Harker. For the record, I'm Lauren King, the Chief Information Officer for the Department of Justice. Excuse me. The relationship with the state office of the Chief Information Office is truly as an oversight body for large projects, but we also view them as a partner with our project, because we know that we don't have the expertise and the experience in performing projects of this size, and we really do want this project to be successful. So we have partnered with them. They do have an oversight role. They do. They will hold the independent verification and validation contract that is really the federal contract and the federal eyes and ears on the project. So it is truly an oversight but yet partnership role on the project.
And I'll elaborate a little bit just on that structure there, which might help you with the relationships. The double-lined boxes there are project leadership, but the single-lined are the advisory groups or other agency participants. The vendor contracts are in the dotted line boxes, and then the dotted connections are information sharing, and then the solid lines are the direct report connections.
Do you want to follow up?
I do, but I think I should take it offline.
Okay. I think I might be able to quickly answer that, okay. If I may, Co-Chair Devlin and Representative Harker. I believe that this was a project structure that we also used in documentation that we sent to the Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement. You see that CIO's office kind of hanging out there because, as you'll recall, they require the contract for their independent verification and validation contractor to be held by a separate agency. So that was an illustration to show them that we understood that, and we have identified that our state chief information office will be holding that contract.
Okay, thanks. I'll still take it offline, but I applaud you for recognizing that. I take your word for it that you don't have the technical expertise in-house to pull off this project. We don't either. That's what that chief information officer is for.
Right.
Please proceed.
Okay. Where? I'm going to go quickly through this timeline to make up a little bit of time here, if that's okay. I think most important here is just to let you know that we have completed the feasibility study. We have completed the implementation advanced planning document, which is the funding instrument through the federal office that I'll talk a little bit more about on another slide. We're nearly completed with a business process reengineering, which will feed into the implementation project. And that last long timeline that you see represents the project as a whole in implementing the new system.
And I will say on that slide, you do see an end date, and that is our working end date. But going back to the original point, that will be adjusted as necessary or if necessary.
Again, we're in the early stages of the project, so what's keeping us busy at this time was the advanced planning document to the federal office. The what we fondly refer to as the IAPD is a written plan of action that the program must use to receive the federal funding, but equally important, it is a complex document that outlines all stages of the project plan from initial planning through the anticipated life of the system. So this instrument is used by the federal government to also to determine its confidence in the program's ability to demonstrate that it can effectively plan and efficiently manage a project of this size from start to finish. That has been approved by the federal office as of the 31st of December. And so we are continuing the development of our foundational documents that will govern the project. One of the most important ones that has been completed is our procurement plan, which is a plan that simply outlines the process and timeline for procuring the four major vendors that will assist us in managing this project. And Kate told you a little bit about those. The quality assurance, sorry?
And Representative Thatcher has a question.
Yeah, previous slide. Okay. The foundational documents, procurement plan, does any of this talk about how one would attack the writing of the contract? Because I think that could have some big consequences down the road. Is that included in this?
Senator, as Co-Chair Devlin and Representative Thatcher, I'm not sure that the procurement plan goes into the drafting of the contract as much as it talks about the standard requirements under the state procurement. How we've addressed that, however, is we are partnering with the DAS Chief Information Office. Nick Betzikon is our lead analyst who has been assisting us in the development of all of our procurement documents, including a team of Department of Justice attorneys from the Business Transactions Office. We have examples of RFPs from other state child support programs, and we have met with them post-procurement and post-implementation to focus on their lessons learned. So what wasn't in that contract that later resulted in a change order, increasing the costs, and so we're trying to learn from the states that have come before us so that we ensure that we get that into the document prior to its release.
Right. I just want to comment that it might be good to just weigh the pros and cons of the different types of contracts out there. Like we talked to eCourt and they said they had a flat fee payment based on outcomes basically and deliverables. So
That is exactly what we're doing.
Okay, thank you.
And they are also one of the agencies that we have met with and consulted in terms of their lessons learned.
And serves on, I will add, and serves on our steering committee. And we have also added the attorney in charge of the business transactions section to our steering committee as well. It's important to have those who are involved in both the procurement documents and ultimately the contract negotiations to be aware of that from the business side too.
So very quickly, the next few slides are just timeline illustrations for each of those procurements. First to be released is the project management contractor RFP to bring in the expertise to help us complete the foundational documents or the governance of this project, followed by the QA, the IVNV, and finally the implementation contractor. And that is all we have.
Any questions from the committee? Yes, Representative Harper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I recall correctly, and it's late and I might not, you're bringing in different elements from three states' certified portions. You're going to have an integrator put them together. Who is the Chief Information Officer reviewing this?
Yes, co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Harker, indeed, I myself will be reviewing all of this as well as all of our technology teams within the Department of Justice. We are also bringing subject matter experts with our integrator who will have had experience integrating large and complex systems. We are also having conversations with and, in fact, members of the Enterprise Technology Services Group, formerly known as State Data Center, is also on our steering committee. So we have a lot of different folks looking at the different components from the states and the technologies that will be used.
And one thing I might add, too, is that the hybrid solution, which is bringing in these different systems, that is one of the recognized options that the federal government expects. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, we know already that we will have other states looking to our system for the same sort of either to pick up and transfer it wholesale or to take important pieces of it. I will make the note that it's the base system will be the California system, and there are smaller components, a reporting component from another state and a financial component. Oh, no, I said it backwards.
Document generation
and
data warehousing.
Got it.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I congratulate you, ladies. You guys can do it, and Cover Oregon can't.
That's what we're here to show you.
Well, I think actually,
that we can.
Senator Olson, I think actually if I can shorten Representative Harker's question, I think what he's trying to get at is there is now a state chief information officer.
Yes.
Is it the understanding from the various divisions of the executive branch that chief information officer, his or her office, it's a he now, but it could be a her in the future, has the ability to say to an agency, stop, hold back, I want something more done before you proceed? Is that your understanding? I mean, that's, I think, what Representative Harker is trying to get at, is does the chief information officer actually have the authority, or in the executive branch, is the current chief information officer, newly created, perceived as having that authority?
Go ahead.
I'll take the hot question here. because you know I work for an independent elected. The
yes, yeah, and I know that it's at least not the judicial branch.
But I'll put it this way. This is still a federal certified project,
right,
and we have to meet their requirements. And that's one of the reasons the IVNV contract is there, so that the feds can also do that. That said, we have our QA vendor, and we have our open and collaborative partnership with the CIO's office. And so you bet, if anyone starts to raise a hand to say, hey, stop, slow down, or we've got something going sideways here, we're all talking about that up front.
Trying to get it. Okay.
We're still going to talk
anything
online.
Anything
expecting questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank everyone here for staying so late, and thank the committee for the indulgence of going a little bit beyond schedule. Enjoy.
I'm amazed that everybody's still here. Yeah. We've never done that before.
I'm looking for that double time.
And
they're reminding me to adjourn the meeting.
You're right.
To adjourn the meeting.
You're right.
And they're reminding me.